Our poet evokes a holy place, a place where we might feel safe enough to open our hearts to the stories others have to tell, a place where we can put aside our own thoughts long enough to summon the presence to simply listen, and then bring our thoughts back to engage. When I read this piece, I imagine the words being offered to a human companion close to the poet, a friend maybe, or a lover, and then I imagine what it might be like to speak those words to another person. I think about the vulnerability it takes to open to someone enough to create this holy space together, and about the times in my life that I have been able to do just that. I remember how it feels to create spaces of trust and deep sharing, spaces in which we can open our hearts to each other. I want to listen to the words behind your words, the way I hear the river inside what first seems to be silence, and then it is all I hear. And then I read it again, and I become mindful of all there is to listen to. Each other in our individual relationships, as I started off talking about, yes, for sure. We start by creating holy space between us. The Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh calls this practice deep listening, and that just so happens to be our theme for the month of October, living love through the practice of deep listening. He says, with edits for gendered language, deep listening is the kind of listening that can help relieve the suffering of another person. You can call it compassionate listening. You listen with only one purpose, to help them empty their heart. Even if they say things that are full of wrong perceptions, full of bitterness, you are still capable of continuing to listen with compassion. Because you know that listening like that, you give that person a chance to suffer less. If you want to help them correct their perception, you wait for another time. For now, you don't interrupt. You don't argue. If you do, they lose their chance. You just listen with compassion and help them suffer less. 1 hour like that can bring transformation and healing. So we can offer each other transformation and healing in our individual relationships when we enter this holy place together. And we introduce our reading each week with the reminder that Unitarian Universalists honor wisdom from many sources. This is one of the things that I love about being part of the liberal religious tradition, and it's the thing that also sometimes strikes fear into my heart. There is always more to learn that can change how I see the world and my place in it. It's pretty amazing how Unitarians and Universalists have, over the centuries, built new theology in this way. They started with reinterpretations of the scriptures, finding evidence for their so-called heretical beliefs about God and Jesus in reading them through lenses not sanctioned by the church, lenses of reason and clarity. They moved into changing the focus of what's important away from doctrine and toward tolerance, then acceptance, and then welcome. All the while, they made room for an ever wider range of beliefs in the process, and this required, as it still does, a larger practice of deep listening. This is hard to do. There is a part of me that misses the surety of my Lutheran background, the firm knowledge that God will take care of me as long as I believe the accepted doctrine. A little part of me groans a little bit every time as I figure out there's yet another new way of understanding or making meaning that I have to consider when I listen to others. Because it's hard work to be continually building what I know, what I believe. And it opens me up to scrutiny and possible criticism by others and the ever-ensuing self-doubt. And maybe more importantly, it makes me examine all the information that comes in to weigh it against what I know. And I don't mean just what I know in my head, but what I know in my gut, what I value. Like Mick Cooper, a psychologist who trains counselors, said, pluralism isn't easy. It's a constant willingness to self-challenge and to look where we might be wrong or limited, even with regard to pluralism itself. It requires a capacity to detach ourselves from our agendas, our beliefs, our commitments, and to recognize that there may be other ways. And it also requires us to recognize that we can never wholly achieve that. The gift of the practice of deep listening is this capacity and the ability to make peace with knowing it's not easy. I want to meet your words and not lose my own words. I want to hear their evolving duet, this song we write together with every conversation, every silence. This is what's needed for this kind of theology to work, to become an evolving duet between what we think we know and what else there is to learn through our listening. We don't tend to learn from what we're hearing when we're already sure. When we practice listening, excuse me. When we practice listening for possibilities instead of for evidence to support our views, it becomes possible to recognize and change the stories that don't really serve us. So this is important in our faith tradition. But our faith tradition doesn't exist in a bubble. One of the reasons many of us seek out religious community is to have a place to fill our cups, to give us what we need to live authentically in the world. And we live in a world of stories. Stories we've been brought up with, stories we've been taught, stories we tell ourselves and each other, stories that are spun by people in power. Stories about who we are, what we value, and who others are, and what they value. Stories from different perspectives. Stories that serve us, and stories that don't. Take, for example, the story of how Christopher Columbus came to the shores of the Americas. Here's a version of his story that I did not learn in school in the 1970s, which I have summarized from a website called The Oatmeal, and a book by Ward Churchill called Indians Are Us. When asked to describe Christopher Columbus, most people say two things. He was a brave explorer who, despite terrible odds, sailed across the Atlantic and proved that the world was round. And he was a tireless, courageous hero who discovered the New World. In 1491, nobody, including Christopher Columbus and Queen Isabella, thought the world was flat. Did you know that? I didn't know that. His initial voyage to the New World was revelatory, but not particularly fruitful. Columbus knew he had stumbled onto something big, but he was focused on gold, not so much the discovery of a new landmass. This focus was partially fueled by the natives themselves, the Lucayan branch of the Taino people, for they wore gold jewelry that Columbus immediately took note of in his journal. And the source of that gold became his primary objective from then on out. When Columbus returned home, he took 25 Lucayan natives with him. 7 survived the voyage. When he got back to Spain, he sold the queen on the idea of a new world saturated in wealth and prosperity. She then outfitted him with 17 ships, 1,500 men, and an arsenal of swords, crossbows, and cannons. he went back to the New World and demanded that the Lucayan people give his men food and gold and let them have sex with their women. When they refused, he had his men cut off their ears and noses and sent them back to their villages. The Lucayans rebelled, and Columbus and his men slaughtered them. In the meantime, he wasn't finding the gold he wanted, and so he rounded up another 500 Lucayan natives, chained them below the decks of his ships, and brought them to Spain to be sold as slaves. 300 of these people survived the voyage. His men captured another 500 natives and forced them into slavery in the New World. Many Lucayans fled into the mountains, and Columbus's men hunted them down and killed them. When he came back to the New World as the governor of the Caribbean islands, he set up a tribute system in which natives who brought him gold bought their safety from him for a short time. Natives who didn't comply had their hands cut off. His policies of slavery and systematic extermination reduced the number of Lucayans from about 8 million to 3 million and created a mass imbalance in the ecology and workforce of those native people, and his policies resulted in their eventual complete extinction. Columbus's gold exports also resulted in the paralysis of the gold economy of Africa's Gold Coast. This led to the rise of African slaves as the dominant commodity in that region, which inadvertently makes Columbus the father of the transatlantic slave trade. This is a story that asks us to unlearn the story, the old story, of a hero who, against all the odds known at the time, bravely sailed forth and found the earth to be round and discovered a new world. It asks that we relearn our own history as beginning in greed and brutality. As hard as this is, once we hear the new story, we find that we can no longer hear the old story through the perspective we once did. It is no longer useful as a narrative to guide us, and we have to move forward with a new perspective. Mark Hicks, the Angus MacLean Associate Professor of Religious Education at Meadville Lombard Theological School, writes that transformation requires people to give up old ways of making meaning in order for new ways to take hold. The old story gives us an unrealistic ideal on which to cling. The new story gives us a more complete picture of a man driven by his own greed to commit horrible acts against people he viewed as other. And so it gives us a lesson on our own potential to do harm. I am grateful, hard as it is, for this version of the story, because it's offered me a chance to wrestle with the harm that the supremacy mindset that grounds the old story has caused. I'm grateful for the many communities that have renamed tomorrow Indigenous Peoples Day, including Wisconsin, since 2019, and for the 2021 presidential proclamation of it as a national holiday, Indigenous Peoples Day. It is way past time to let go of the old story that didn't serve us. And when I say us, when I say didn't serve us, I mean the whole of us. The collective us that comes from different cultural backgrounds, different languages, different ways of understanding and knowing. And so, in this very fraught season, I am thinking about other stories, past and present, that don't serve the collective us. And bizarrely, my brain keeps landing on old television shows. I think TV is a reflection of the stories we tell ourselves, right? So the 1950s, showing Leave It to Beaver as an all-American family. And the Brady Bunch, right? The 1970s show about a blended family whose interpersonal issues were always solved by the end of that half-hour show. The late 1970s brought us All in the Family, which actually introduced some real social issues, but through a comedic lens, because how else would we be expected to process them? And the Jeffersons, in the same time frame, about a black family living the American dream. The world depicted in these stories never really existed. That's what I think. Except maybe for a privileged few, and the expectations that they set for us did real harm. And I can't observe all of that without thinking about how one of the loudest stories in our time, right now, is a call to go back to a society like those fictional times, in which what's acceptable behavior is defined by a dominant few, and outliers are at best ignored, and at worst marginalized, prosecuted, deported. Yikes. So, I invite us to think for a few moments about old stories that don't serve us, and how we might learn new stories to replace them. I like to use the phrase, what if, when I think about new stories. And for me, I think about some things like, what if other people really do know what they're doing and things will be fine if I don't get involved in everything? What if I understood myself as strong instead of stubborn, as beautiful instead of flawed, as wise instead of opinionated, as worthy of love and care instead of a burden? What if my mom was teaching me resilience when it felt like neglect? What if that sixth grade bully was suffering and acting out? What if I am enough? For ourselves collectively, I think, what if inclusion means more than just what I need? What if we have relationships with a wide variety of people, with a wide variety of stories? What if we have enough resources of time, talent, and treasure to sustain this amazing congregation and make a positive impact on our community? What if a world where peace and sustainability are valued more than individualism is possible? What if we are enough? Native American storyteller Thomas King writes that the truth about stories is that's all we are. If this is true, then there is an awful lot of emotional investment in what we think we know. And letting go of old stories can be deeply personal challenges. And in the good company of others who are also challenging what we have learned about society, about the world order, about privilege, about entitlement, we can meet that challenge and build that just and sustainable world. Letting go of the old stories makes it possible to imagine new stories and to create new systems that can take care of us all. And when we have the support of beloved community, this is possible and maybe just a little easier. May it be so. And may we be so.